Well, you can imagine the Chinese reaction to a foreigner's, especially an adversary's, advice, probably about the same as would be her reaction if a Chinese official made suggestions for improving the U.S. economy. In fact, China's Commerce Minister Wang Wentao disputed the idea of overcapacity, calling it groundless. He touted China's contribution to fighting climate change through its green exports, saying, quote, "The Chinese government will fully support and defend the rights of the industry because our electric vehicle development has made important contributions in the process of the world's green transitioning," unquote. Wang also defended the EV industry against the charge that its successes were due to government subsidies, saying, quote, "China's electric vehicle companies are competitive due to the innovation of technology and comprehensiveness of its supply chain network." What really concerns the Chinese is that their EVs will become subject to high tariffs in Europe, where they are flooding the market and challenging German-made and other EVs. To be sure, overcapacity is a problem for China, and exporting as a way out of it is a time-worn solution that may not work for long. European Union countries are the leading complainers, and Chinese EVs are complicating their relations with Europe. But let the Chinese figure that one out, and let Yellen get back to the business of business at home. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 16, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and ideas at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertow. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Tramel Gomes, and Nadia Ramlagan. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. By the way, all of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. We would very much like it if you would consider becoming a member and supporting our programming. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio, and have a great night.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gasco. It is really important that we celebrate our victories when we get them, and today we get to talk about two of them. The Oregon Board of Forestry recently voted to approve its first ever habitat conservation plan on state forests, and a bill to fully fund and strengthen Oregon's Marine Reserve Program sailed through the recent legislative session. To talk about these victories and get updates on what's ahead for both of these campaigns, I'm joined by Charlie Plybond from Surfrider Foundation and Michael Lang from the Wild Salmon Center. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by Michael to break down the Habitat Conservation Plan victory and a few other important state forest updates. But first, we're going to hear about the big win for Oregon's Marine Reserves with Charlie. And we've done deep dives into both of these campaigns on previous episodes, so if you get excited and want to learn more, check out our free archive on the Coast Range Radio podcast or at our website, coastrange.org. And as always, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Charlie Plybond, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be here.
Yeah, well, first of all, congratulations on passing HB 4132, the Marine Reserves Bill. I know you worked probably harder than anyone except possibly Representative David Gomberg and his staff on getting this bill passed. So first off, how does it feel to get this bill passed, especially after the first attempt was unsuccessful a year ago?
Thanks, Michael. It's been, it feels great. You know, this is a big win for Oregon's ocean, for all Oregonians who care about our oceans, who love seafood, who love wildlife, who love important habitats, and care about climate change. So it feels great. You know, after the first year there, we weren't so successful. And I think a lot of that had to do with not building quite the right team. This time go around, we had a really strong coalition, a lot of great groups, a lot of other organizations beyond Surfrider Foundation really helped out with this bill and really helped us get it across the finish line.
So let's talk about the bill itself. We're going to break down a few of the key components in a minute, but just overview, why is this bill important? Why should people care? Why is this a win for oceans and Oregonians?
Well, you can think about Oregon's marine reserves like parks in our ocean. In fact, they're the only parks in our ocean, and they are dedicated to not only habitat protection and protecting wildlife, but also long-term research and monitoring. So better understanding how our ocean is changing, understanding and catching you know, significant events like sea star wasting disease, understanding better ocean acidification, which is an impact of climate change and how that's impacting habitats. And where we might have resilient habitats. So beyond them just being parks, they're, you know, living laboratories for Oregonians to learn more about our oceans and ultimately adapt and provide more resilience to things like climate change.
Absolutely. Well put. So can you walk us through the key components of this bill and how they will strengthen the Marine Reserve program?
Absolutely. First and foremost, it helps better staff the Oregon Marine Reserves program. So Oregon Marine Reserves are managed by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So they have a very small staff. In fact, before this bill passed, they only had about three or four staff that were dedicated full time to working on the Marine Reserves. And so this will improve the staffing, in particular, some of the science staff, some of the social science staff. What the bill does, though, is it actually mandates some additional things for the agency to do, four kind of primary areas that it's moves forward the agency and the Marine Reserve program. One is it's going to require the agency to establish community and tribal engagement goals. Marine reserves are really important to communities. Our ocean resources are really important culturally to tribes. Better understanding and connecting communities to these protected areas is a really important part of the program. And so establishing goals and mandating those goals for the agency to engage their communities and engage tribes is one really important element of the bill. Another important element is evaluating the Marine Reserve system as a network. So when you think about all these, what we would call parks maybe in the ocean, you know, they're spread out, they're a system, they're not connected. And that's really important when we think about larval dispersal, how animals migrate, and really protecting a resilient and strong network means evaluating these areas and their connectivity. So better understanding how they may be connected, the ones on the south coast versus the ones on the north coast, whether or not we need to adapt and change those. The third major element of the bill requires an adaptive management plan for climate change. As we all know, our oceans are changing. Climate is impacting our oceans. What we protected 20 years ago might not make sense for the future. We might need to protect more. We might need to protect less. We need to adapt these areas as we see the ocean changes. So the third area is it's going to force the agency to develop an adaptive management plan. The final area, which I think is really exciting, is it kind of creates a roadmap for social and ecological policy recommendations. So it's great to protect the ocean. It's great to learn about the ocean, but how we use that information in from our marine reserves, the science that we're gathering, what we're learning about ocean acidification, ultimately needs to affect policy and help change rules. This could open up more fisheries. This could particularly change how we fish and where we fish. It may help us better understand how fishing regulations impact our coastal communities. These are all important areas for our marine reserves to teach us and be those living laboratories that ultimately affect change. So those are kind of the four major areas that we can think about when we think about how this bill will work on our marine reserve program.
There is a lot there, and I really wish we could kind of dig into each one of those. And I'm hopeful that on a future episode, we'll be able to get the ODFW's Marine Reserve Program Coordinator, Program Leader, I should say, Lindsay Aylesworth, to kind of give us that deeper understanding of each of those points. But for now, you know, this isn't just done and put on a shelf. The implementation is what comes next. So how can the public not only engage with Marine Reserves coming up, but really engage with the program itself and learn about what ODFW is doing here?
Absolutely. Well, the part of the mandate for the agency is to have these community engagement goals. And so they're actually mandated for you, the Oregonians out there, to get more involved and to better understand these areas. One thing is you can check out the Marine Reserve website. That's where their clearinghouse is for the agency of all their information. OregonMarineReserves.com is a place where you can coast on over. You can, run through their different data outputs. They have these really cool, what they call data dashboards that help you better understand what we're learning and how that information is being used. You can do a fly-through through all the Marine Reserves. They have sort of an aerial fly-through that lets you go through Google Map and sort of swim underwater and see these areas. Cool videos and photos. They put divers in the water. They put submersible vehicles underwater, and they get great footage. These are all things that are there for you to explore on OregonMarineReserves.com. But also, we have great groups of communities that are dedicated to engaging with the Marine Reserves. These are like small nonprofits or community groups, and they're based around each Marine Reserve. And you can check out and learn more about what they're doing at omrp.org. That's Oregon Marine Reserve Partnership.org. And all of these different communities, they do a lot of great work. They do citizen science. They can help you get involved in, counting seabirds and understanding what kind of seabirds are using each areas. I'm getting involved in marine debris surveys, water quality monitoring, a whole host of activities that these different groups engage in and help Oregonians connect better to our oceans.
Yeah, those are both great websites. Thanks for bringing those up. And I just have to plug, we've all encountered government websites that are not very fun to use. OregonMarineReserves.com is not one of them. That is an excellent, excellent website and so fun to go on and click around. So what's next for this program and what's next on your radar for Oregon ocean conservation that you want folks to know about?
Well, I talked a little bit about climate change and our changing ocean, and I think that's one of the biggest things that our fisheries and Oregonians are going to grapple with. Mm-hmm. Folks, often don't think about their connectivity to the ocean if they live far inland, but we are all inextricably connected to our ocean. Whether you like to eat seafood or whether you like to breathe oxygen, those are some fundamental ways that we're all connected to our ocean, and those things are changing. Oysters are not as easy to culture as they used to be because of ocean acidification. That's the lowering of the pH in our oceans is making it harder for us to grow oysters in our bays and estuaries. That's requiring us to adapt. Now, we've done some great things to adapt to that, but we're learning that we might not have as the same kind of seafood available to us in the future. We may have to adapt our fisheries and look at new types of fisheries, explore different fisheries that may not exist today. And those are all sort of things that are impacting us every day. I'm not sure if Oregonians like to go to the beach and clam. I know I do, but if there's a lot of Oregonians out there that like to do clamming, you may have noticed that we've had an increase of what they call harmful algal blooms over the years, which has made it, restricting our clam season a little bit because of, toxic chemicals associated with those harmful algal blooms. And so all kinds of things are impacting our ocean. And I think better understanding how we adapt to those changing ocean conditions. We can't stop Mother Nature from changing, but we can adapt. We can better protect our resources, and we can learn how to be more resilient. And I really believe that our marine reserves are really the key to helping us understand how to adapt to climate change, how to adapt to changing oceans, changing fisheries, and ultimately have a healthy and happy future with our oceans.
Well, is there anything else we've missed before we bring this to a close?
I don't think so. I thought we've done a nice job covering the business here, Michael.
Yeah.
If you know me, I can talk for hours, and so I think I do good just to get us in our time limit here. And I know you have more to say, so I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
No, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your perspective. And one more time, congratulations. Thank you so much for your hard work, Charlie. There are not a lot of ocean advocates that work as hard as you do for these oceans. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Michael. That means a lot.
So once again, you're listening to Coast Range Radio, and we are celebrating a couple big victories on today's episode. Next up is my conversation with Michael Lang, the Senior Policy Manager for the Wild Salmon Center. Michael led the coalition of groups pushing for a habitat conservation plan, also referred to as an HCP, on Oregon State Forest, and honestly probably deserves a grove of forest named in his honor at this point. So, Michael, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
Yeah. Well, first of all, congratulations. Thank you for your tireless efforts on this. It's been great to work with you. How did it feel when that vote came down in Salem a few weeks ago to finalize the HCP, even after Hampton Lumber and other big timber players had thrown everything they had at the wall to stop this?
Well, it's a great feeling, Michael, and it's a good step forward for all Oregonians that want their state forests to have balanced management. Our polling has shown that Oregonians overwhelmingly prefer protection of wildlife and salmon, and also clean water, clean cold water, and safe drinking water that comes from our state forests. So this is a real victory for Oregon. It's a victory for the communities that surround our state forests that depend on these forests for their quality of life and for safe drinking water. There was, yes, opposition to this, but that was anticipated. For almost 25 years, the state and the Department of Forestry has sought a habitat conservation plan for state forest, and they've been unsuccessful because of opposition from the timber industry. This time, I'm very proud of the Board of Forestry and their staff for making this key decision to move forward with a habitat conservation plan for our Western Oregon State Forest.
So we should probably say what a habitat conservation plan is, what are our state forests. So we actually did an episode last year with Bob Reese, kind of going into all of this in detail, but give us just a brief overview for folks that might not be familiar. What's a habitat conservation plan and what land are we talking about here?
A habitat conservation plan is really a compliance tool for the Federal Endangered Species Act. And what a habitat conservation plan does for a landowner is it requires them to set aside suitable habitat for species that are listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And in this case, this plan would cover 17 species, several species of salmon, and then upland species like marbled murrelet, avian species, and the northern spotted owl too. So this plan would be in place for 70 years, and it requires the state of Oregon to set aside enough habitat to ensure the continued survival of these species. In return, it can carry out other management practices on these lands too, in this case, logging outside of these key habitat conservation areas and riparian conservation areas. So in sum, it is a way to comply with the Federal Endangered Species Act, protect habitat for endangered species, and allow other land uses to continue on the land as well. So it's a balance. A little bit about what it's not. This is not a recovery plan for these species. And I think that's really important to understand. Nor is it exactly a climate change and carbon plan. And I'll touch on that a little bit later.
Yeah, well, I hope you do. I mean, maybe you could talk a little bit about that in my next question, is what are the stakes here? Why is this so important to us? Why is this important to all Oregonians, and why are the most powerful players in Oregon's timber industry so dead set against something that will still allow them to log almost half or maybe over half of state forests?
Great question. The Western Oregon State Forest encompassed 640,000 acres west of the Cascades, but the majority of that, over 500,000 acres, is in Northwest Oregon in the Tillamook and the Clatsop State Forest too. And these forests hold six world-class salmon and steelhead rivers and habitat for some of the species I mentioned before, overall 17 species. It gets 100 inches of rain annually in this forest, and the whole network is just this natural salmon factory there too. But historically, these lands have been treated almost as private timberland. There are mills surrounding these state forests, and there has been constant pressure to overharvest these forests. For over 25 years, the state has tried to put in place a habitat conservation plan. It's been resisted by the timber industry that wants to continue to manage our public forests like private timberland. We want to restore balance to that and make sure that we're protecting values like fish and wildlife habitat and clean water on our public forest along with recreation. And that's what this plan does.
You kind of touched on what was going to be my next question, which is like an abbreviated history of this campaign. But
sure.
If you do have any other highlights over the last, especially few years.
Yeah, I'd be happy to give you some context. It was more than 20 years ago that the state decided we need to protect habitat on state forests. We're going to put in place a habitat conservation plan, and we're going to set the goal to have 50 to 60% of our state forest in complex forest structure for these animals that are dependent on older, mature forests. Well, over time, the state continued to allow the overharvest of these forests. So by 2010, the amount of complex forest structure was down to 30%. So the state moved the goalpost. They said, oh, okay, now we're going to protect 30%. That's our goal for complex layered forest habitat. Well, as of last year, it was down to 11% across state forests. 11%. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, the Oregon Department of Forestry, with pressure from the timber industry, has kept over-harvesting these forests. And that's why it was essential to put in place a plan to restore balance to our state forests. Plus, there were lawsuits that were filed, too, under the Federal Endangered Species Act. And the state realized, hey, we're really exposed here. If we don't want the whole forest shut down, we better put in place a plan to protect habitat. So starting in 2018, they started developing this habitat conservation plan.
Yeah.
You might get the sense now that this isn't easy.
Yeah. I mean, I remember on a call you and I were recently on, someone asserted that this is the first time that the timber industry has lost. I mean, if you don't include the Northwest Forest Plan on federal forests. And I don't know if that's true, but it certainly feels true that the timber industry is just used to winning, 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 and we're used to losing, losing, losing. So why do you think we are able to achieve this victory now after all of these years? You know, do you think that the tide is finally turning to where the timber industry doesn't have that iron grip on our agencies and legislature that it used to?
Yeah, I think your last statement is true. The iron grip has slipped. But in perspective, these state forest lands compared to our statewide forest are only 3% of all forest land in Oregon. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's federal, but a lot of it's private. And it's a tiny percentage of the overall timber harvest in the state. So it really matters to just a few timber companies that get a lot of logs off our state forest and depend on those too. I think there has been a shift with the Board of Forestry, with the Department of Forestry staff, and with leadership in the legislature, and with our governor. They realize we can't continue like this. We have to restore balance. And guess what? federal law is mandatory. The Endangered Species Act is not something discretionary that the states can ignore. Either they're going to enact a habitat conservation plan, or they're going to be subject to litigation under the Endangered Species Act that could put a stop to all logging activities on state forest. And the state doesn't want to go down that road. So this is the most pragmatic path forward for the state to protect habitat on state forest land, and also the least risk. And again, I have to go back to the fact that this is mandatory federal law. You got to comply. Mm-hmm. So the state is taking the right steps in that direction.
Yeah. And just to underscore, not only is this something the state has to do, but it's also a significant compromise. You know, we are celebrating this as a victory, but, you know, I think our entire state forest coalition agrees that this is not the plan that we would have drawn up. It's obviously not the plan the timber industry would have drawn up, but, you know, there's more work to be done, and I do want to talk to you about looking forward. But I also just real quick want to underscore that, you know, a lot of folks are cynical about progress, but I think this demonstrates that with sustained public pressure, you know, we can change the makeup of agencies, the makeup of the shape of the public debate. And I just wonder, you know, how important that public pressure and public engagement was in making this campaign successful, in fortifying the Board of Forestry in the face of that unrelenting pressure.
Well, public engagement was critical. And I would estimate tens of thousands of Oregonians weighed in and sent comments to the Board of Forestry, the governor, and legislators calling for a strong habitat conservation plan. That public support and pressure was critical in giving the Board of Forestry and elected officials the will to really move forward with what they know is right, what they know is the only course, in the face of stiff opposition from the timber industry. So that public engagement was absolutely critical. Before I forget, if you want to learn more and get engaged, go to Stand Tall Oregon, our website, our coalition website, to find out more, or wildsalmoncenter.org to get more information on how to stay engaged, because this isn't over. The Habitat Conservation Plan is a compromise. It protects 70% of mature forest on state forest, but you know that there's another 30% out there that isn't included. It increases buffers preventing logging near salmon-bearing streams, but recent science shows that those buffers could be larger to prevent adverse effects to downstream amphibians too. So again, this is a compromise. It's a work in progress too, and there are other important decisions coming up over the next year that it's really important for the public to weigh in on.
Well, that is a perfect segue to my last couple questions I have for you is, what is on the horizon? You know, why do people need to stay engaged? What are we looking at here?
What is coming up next year? There's another decision point with the Oregon Board of Forestry. When the habitat plan federal review is finalized, there will be another vote, and that will be a vote to implement the habitat conservation plan. Following that, a new forest management plan will go into rulemaking, and that includes the habitat conservation plan. I'll call it the HCP, but it also is broader than that. There is a climate change and carbon plan adopted in 2021 by the Board of Forestry that really hasn't been implemented. That forest management plan is a great opportunity to implement this climate plan that calls for establishing Oregon as a national leader in climate smart forestry. What does that mean? Guess what? There's no definition in state law for climate smart forestry. That's where public engagement and pressure can really come to bear with the Department of Forestry and the Board of Forestry to say, let's define what that goal means and let's implement that through this new forest management plan where we're actually capturing, sequestering more carbon in our state forest and also storing that carbon for longer in our state forest. So that's kind of outside of the scope of the HCP and an upcoming opportunity in 2025. And the last thing I'll say is that The timber industry is not happy with this, and they are going to make another run in the 2025 session of the legislature to undo this habitat conservation plan and increase clear cuts on state forests. So the public has to stay engaged. Many of you may know this, but endurance is like 99% of winning protection for our state forest and our public resources, and we have to keep that effort going through the next few years.
Absolutely. As my recent interview with Paul Koberstein, the author of Canopy of Titans, put it, you know, we have to win and win and win, and the forests only have to get cut once for us to lose, right? So we have to protect those forests every day, and that climate piece, that carbon sequestration piece is so important. So how should people learn more about kind of what's on the horizon and stay engaged?
Yeah, that's a great way to close here. And again, going to standtalloregon.org and sign up to learn more about this and learn how to take action. Also go to wildsalmoncenter.org and sign up for news and for action alerts on how to stay engaged as well. And that'll steer you to decision points that are coming up and provide the background information where the citizens of our state can become informed about these issues and also have opportunities to engage and help shape public policy on our state forest and other public lands.
Well, Michael Lang, I just want to thank you so much for joining us and for all of your hard work. It is so appreciated.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, and also likewise, thank you for all of your great work.
And that's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. You can find links and resources to everything we discussed today in the episode description of the podcast or at our website, coastrange.org. If you want to get in touch, my email is
michael@coastrange.org. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio.
KBOO's board is recruiting directly.